great, because I was actually quite hungry by now. But the same thing happened again. He put the potatoes on, and then he just forgot that they were on there. And the whole room filled with steam again. And finally, the potatoes had kind of turned into fragments, little fragments of potato. And that's what we ate. But it was such a long time after the cooking had started that we got to eat.
As Brian takes his first bite of this cybernetically kosher meal, it becomes clear that History Box will probably avoid any mention of this culinary masterpiece.
It was not a memorable meal. not a Michelin star job.
It's hard to believe that this terrible chef once dreamt of running the economy of an entire country. In Washington, news of Letelier's assassination hits hard. The U.S. government is worried about this. They're supposed to be friends with Pinochet's Chile. Could it really be true that they would send assassins to the American capital in order to get rid of one of their dissidents? So the American government starts investigating and looking into what's going on. It's at this point that one high-ranking official at the State Department writes to his boss, Henry Kissinger, by then Secretary of State, a very disturbing note which expresses a lot of concerns and anxieties about what's going on in Chile.
The security forces of the Southern Cone now coordinate intelligence activities closely. They operate in the territory of one another's countries in pursuit of subversives. They have established Operation Condor to find and kill terrorists of the Revolutionary Coordinating Committee in their own countries.
So what else does this memo have to say about Operation Condor? Well, here it is, in black and white.
There is extensive cooperation between the security intelligence operations of six governments: Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Their intelligence services hold formal meetings to plan Operation Condor. It will include extensive FB1 type exchanges of information about shady characters. There are plans for a special communications network.
It's a typo, by the way. What was meant was FBI-type exchanges of information. So this is what the memo is referring to. The reason for this network is shockingly clear: to carry out assassinations, to torture, to kidnap, to do whatever one can to get rid of all those shady leftist characters. And it's been going on for a while, apparently, with very little resistance from the United States. On matters of dark tech, Manuel Contreras is still ahead of everyone. Here's Francesca Lessa giving us a detailed breakdown of what Condor actually entailed.
The first one was CondorTel, which was a secret encrypted system that guaranteed quick and fluid communications between the members of Condor. The second feature was Condor Eje, which was the operational office that in practice conducted these abduction operations or murder operations on the ground. Then we also had an archive of information or a sort of centralized database that basically collated all the information that these countries were sharing on the targets.
The resemblance between Condor and CyberSyn is striking, to say the least.
Let me tell you what I know about Condor. Condor had a system that had the same elements.
John Dinguez is an investigative reporter who knows Chile all too well. He was even once interrogated by DINA.
Obviously, what I'm trying to nail down is whether the CyberSyn infrastructure, which was computers on the one hand, telex machines on the other hand, hundreds of telex machines, whether obviously these were in the hands of the government after the coup because they were already government property, and whether they were taken over by the intelligence, not just the military, but the intelligence apparatus, DINA, and used in Condor.
Is there a connection between Condor and CyberSyn? I've done some digging myself, but the evidence is far from clear. But does it really matter in the grand scheme of things? Does it really matter if some of the CyberSyn Telex machines were eventually used in the Condor atrocities? After all, the Chilean police had been using this Telex technology for years, even before Allende took office. Rather, it's the symmetry between Condor and CyberSyn that is of most interest. It is quite disturbing just how similar they are in their setup. Judge for yourself. When it comes to Condor, there is a central computer in Santiago, and there is an operations room in Buenos Aires. And it's not even mentioning the Telex network, composed of machines that are connecting intelligence agencies throughout the region. In fact, it's very much like the setup of CyberSyn, only blown to the international scale.
In terms of operations, you have a similar, the analogy is the intelligence agencies in the six countries, later eight countries, were the equivalent of the enterprises, and they're getting reports back and forth.
Condor's operations room in Buenos Aires has no use for ergonomic chairs. As Francesca Lassa points out, the people in this room are here to plan and execute assassinations.
This office was a sort of forward command and coordinating office, and that each Condor country sent at least two officers to be permanently located on the ground in this office to be in charge of processing intelligence, to receive some of the Condortel communications and transform this information into actual orders for raids and kidnappings. And then teams would be dispatched to actually execute the orders.
At least Condor's communications seem secure from the likes of ITT, but is it really so?
Very soon after the founding meeting in late 1975, all the Condor member countries were given this cryptography system that would enable them to transmit communications in a secure way.
Brazil, a country with a long history of repression, is the one to share this cutting-edge cryptographic system with the rest of the Condor network. But where did they get it from? As it turns out, the Brazilians received this encryption equipment from a firm in Switzerland. It all sounds completely innocent, of course. Who would distrust a firm in Switzerland, of all places? But as we'll soon find out, perhaps things are not what they seem. Remember this moment. It's been a struggle to understand the connection between CyberSyn and Condor. But then I had a chat with Jack Zipes, who's the so-called Karl Marx of fairy tales. Yes, he analyzes fairy tales for a living. And only then I understood that these two phenomena, CyberSyn and Condor, are like two versions of the same story. The story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice, whose themes have been present in many fairy tales around the globe. And for a good reason. The tale itself speaks to some profound eternal themes that have to do with human struggles over power and knowledge.
The initial sort of step or phase in the stories that are called The Sorcerer's Apprentice is one in which a young boy learns all the knowledge and magic that a sorcerer can give him or teach him, and he then runs away to use that magic and knowledge for his own interests, for his own sort of, let's say, survival, or for his own meaning in life.
Jack says that there are two types of stories like this. One kind is where the apprentice beats the sorcerer with their own tricks and then changes things for themselves and others. That's the kind of happy end kind of story. But the other kind is where the apprentice fails, and miserably so, and then gets punished or even killed by the sorcerer. That's definitely not your average happy end kind of story. This second version, of course, is much, much grimmer and is not exactly uplifting.
In another set of tales called The Humiliated Apprentice, the apprentice is not smart enough to outdo the sorcerer and is generally punished, tortured, killed, done away with.
You might remember the second kind of narrative from a famous cartoon. Yes, Disney's Fantasia. It's the one where Mickey Mouse messes up with magic and eventually pays the price.
The images at the end are horrific because he more or less, Mickey has to leave as a slave to the sorcerer. And it is a disgusting, putrid film that takes away all any possibility for a young apprentice, that is Mickey Mouse, from becoming his own person.
The Cold War in Latin America produces some rich mutations of both versions of this myth. So take the Santiago boys, for instance. They do take some ideas from American progressives, they mix them up with whatever they glean from British cybernetics, and then they add some German design flair on top. So clearly they are stealing a lot of tricks from all sorts of sorcerers, and eventually, of course, plenty of humiliation follows. But what about the secret police and the military? Weren't they too an apprentice of some kind and to a much more powerful sorcerer than German designers or British cyberneticians? Did Dina, the Caravan of Death, the Operation Condor take their cues from the US? Did they also steal any tricks from them? Of course, it's plausible, considering America's counterinsurgency manuals, its schools for Latin American military personnel, all the surveillance and torture equipment that America kept sending to police departments all over the continent. So, yes, of course, a lot of training and learning did in fact occur. But there is a bigger question here. Does the savage Latin American apprentice actually rebel against the master sorcerer? Or does someone like Manuel Contreras, and others like him, simply follow a prescribed playbook? A playbook that was well known to those in Washington and was very much part of what America expected them to do? That's a tough one. But Latin America, of course, has a way of making old stories new and different. So maybe the story that we do need to tell here is about something else. Maybe it's about the evil sorcerer and his evil apprentice. And somehow both of them kind of get away with everything, even as justice cries. This sounds so much more like what actually happened during the Cold War in Latin America. After nearly 3 years in prison, Fernando Flores is finally released. He traced his former life as a government official for a fellowship at, wait for it, Stanford University. His new home is California.
I survived doing weird things. And this is the part that I want you to know. I am the first minister of finance of South America. I didn't have any money. No money.
Immediately, Fernando has to find new ways of supporting his family.
My wife worked doing sandwich for Marriott. My children were in the afternoon in Burger King after the school. And that's the way that we survived 77, 78.
At Stanford, everyone around him is talking about this new big thing, artificial intelligence. The times really have not changed very much, have they? But what about Fernando's old love, cybernetics? Well, it seems to have fallen out of fashion, at least in Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley was not open to cybernetics.
So Fernando keeps quiet about it, obviously.
I believe that with cybernetics, I cannot make a living in the United States. I will be a guy eccentric looking something from a weird place.
It's a moment that stuck with him over the years. He brings up Stafford in conversation with a leading figure in the field of AI, only to be met with a dismissive laugh.
She said, I met Stafford Beer in Austria. I believe he's crazy. If you hear that, you are not going to say, oh, I have something to tell you about the cyber scene.
To this day, Fernando's attitude to cyber scene, the very project that he helped initiate is at best ambiguous. And as for the Santiago boys, even in exile, their network lives on. Gabriel Rodriguez, for example, arranges for Fernando to travel to Italy, where he meets other Mapu leaders. But this trip turns out to be quite a chaotic affair. Fernando's future lies elsewhere.
It was a crazy meeting, absolutely crazy.
So true to form, Fernando is at the center of controversy.
Something happened that the party never believed him. Eh? And in a certain way, the traditional people that were leaders of the Mapu don't like this Negro Flores that get so fast up and is finally was an access to agenda much better than anyone in the party. So there was a kind of resentment there.
Fernando's mind is a whirlwind of new thoughts and concepts, all these things he learned in prison and now at Stanford. All these ideas about language, philosophy, hermeneutics, biology. There are all these fancy words that he mixes together, and to good effect, one must say. He's still reading books at breakneck pace, and he can't wait to share these revolutionary insights with his former comrades at Mapu.
I told him several times, don't do this, because these guys are going to laugh on your face.
Fernando ignores Gabriel's advice.
Fernando is this kind of person. He was interested in showing to the party the strong discovery he's done on language. You can imagine that the people working in the party were talking about very concrete things to do, how we can help him, people there, in negotiation with the communists, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mapu fails to appreciate Fernando's intellectual curiosity, leaving him with little choice but to seek success elsewhere. And so he turns his attention to Silicon Valley, where he hopes to find a more receptive audience. As it turns out, it's a match made in heaven. Meanwhile, over in Wales, Stafford Beer is rebuilding his life, living in a cottage in the middle of a forest. And he has been making quite an impression on his neighbors from day one. One of those neighbors, Gareth Jones, remembers Stafford's arrival there in the mid-1970s.
We wanted to greet Stafford, and when he arrived then in his woolly jumper, then, which was down to his knees, with a beard, massive beard on his chest, then I thought Father Christmas had come early.
After all, it's not every day that Father Christmas rolls up to a small Welsh village in a luxury car.
He arrived in a Rolls Royce as well, which nobody had heard of in our area. Somebody driving a Rolls Royce down the lane.
Though Stafford may have looked the part of a farmer, he is anything but.
He was far more intelligent than his IQ was way out of our league as ordinary farmers.
At first, local people think he's a bit of a hippie weirdo of some kind, maybe even a vegan, but they quickly warm up to him because of Stafford's charm and wit.
And I was thinking that I'd been in the company of Stafford and Brian Eno. I thought I was privileged, or I was the Lord of the Rings.
For Stafford, this small Welsh cottage is more than just a home. It's a space for him to explore his creativity and spirituality, and to do so in ways that he had never thought possible before. He writes poetry, he dabbles in fiction. Stafford even embraces a thinker he once found repulsive and reactionary. David Whittaker shares his memories.
And he got very into Gandhi's philosophy, you know, and non-violence.
Stafford even mimics his new hero.
There are lots of photos of Gandhi weaving on his spinning wheel some of the basic clothes he used to wear. And Stafford wanted this spinning wheel, and he used to get local lots of sheep around their wool. I don't know the technicalities of weaving, but he used to spend many hours in the evening.
Stafford definitely no longer lives inside Captain Nemo's ship. This cottage doesn't even have running water. This means that Stafford has to get very creative when it comes to managing his water supply, as Vanilla tells us.
Stafford used to go and get water in jerry cans from the toilets in Abiga something, you know, oh, la la. And he had a flow chart for how you use water.
It's a quantified flow chart that would be the envy of any Chilean factory.
You know, there was drinking water, there was tea water, there was washing up water, and the whole thing was protected until it got round to the water for washing the floor.
Eventually, the last vestige of his old world has to go as well. So Stafford sells the Rolls-Royce. Instead, he opts for a more proletarian option.
There was one Land Rover, and when that died, there was another Land Rover. They were called Chimo 1 and Chimo 2. Oh, well, they were old and astonishingly uncomfortable. You know, you get into one of these things and the noise was phenomenal. You couldn't talk.
So as Stafford settles into his new frugal existence, Fernando finds his digital nirvana in the very heart of Silicon Valley. His old world of cybernetic socialism is no match for this new tech mecca. At the time, all the action in Silicon Valley is happening at a place called Xerox Park. And Fernando just loves it there when he visits.
Then I went to Xerox Park and I was so impressed with every story with mouses. Many of the things that we begin to see after in the Apple computer were there in 76.
It's an otherworldly experience.
For me, it was hallucination. I didn't have the categories and the whole thing, but I saw the future.
Fernando is in the right place at the right time. Although cybernetics may no longer be in vogue, it still gives him a head start.
I said, look, I need to find something to do here that use all of this. But I don't see any of these guys dealing with the problem that I was dealing in Chile. That is the managing problem, not the data problem.
One day, Fernando meets the whiz kid of Stanford's computer science department.
He came to my office and he looked up on the wall and there was a poster for Intilimani, which is a Chilean revolutionary singing group. And he said, okay, I'm okay. I'm safe here. This is somebody who is will understand.
This is Terry Vinograd, now a towering figure in the field.
The interaction with Fernando has always had a big impact on me in just broadening my thinking. I described him as the only person I know who could read four hard books before breakfast. I mean, he's voracious intellectual.
Thanks to Terry's introduction, Fernando finds himself pursuing a doctoral degree and doing so with two leading philosophers at the nearby Berkeley. And slowly but surely, Fernando is changing his mind about things. After all those intense reading sessions, he realizes that data alone is not enough for successful management. Instead, he needs a system for coordinating all the people sitting inside the operations room, and not just feeding them the data. So, drawing on his background in philosophy, and also his time as government minister, Fernando creates a new way of management, a way that most people in Silicon Valley are not yet familiar with. As it turns out, a lot of people there are willing to pay top dollar to hear this charismatic and eccentric Chilean man explain his vision. As Fernando tells his friend from Chile around then, we're going to be rich. And as it turns out, he is absolutely right. Ironically, this is also when money problems begin mounting for Stafford Beer, but he pays little attention to them. He finally found the person who makes it all worthwhile, Alana Leonard.
We got together pretty much immediately.
At the time, Alana is a PhD student in cybernetics.
I met Stafford on a trip up here to Toronto for a conference, and eventually, we ended up deciding to live here together. Basically, he wasn't too fond of the U.S. political system, given the Nixon-Kissinger intervention in Chile. And it didn't make any sense for me to try to come to the U.K., particularly since he frequently was in Canada.
While Stafford still enjoys spending time at the cottage, Toronto is becoming increasingly important to him as well, as Vanilla Beer notes.
Stafford's time in Toronto was very special for him. He had a house with a woman he loved, a little garden where he could sit on the what they call a deck and watch the raccoons. No, it was a lovely time. And he liked the area. He was bang in the middle of Toronto.
They've got their cybernetic sorted, that's for sure. There is even a science to picking the right restaurant.
We named, I think, 8 or 10 restaurants, compared them in groups of three. Well, and it was like, well, this one has this kind of food. This one has that kind of food. This one has good French fries, and this one doesn't have good French fries. And this one has uncomfortable seating, and this one has comfortable seating.
One can only guess how they would rank them based on the tastiness of empanadas. Stafford, it seems, has finally found his soulmate. Next on the Santiago Boys, it's time to wrap up our story. But before we do that, we need some answers. Who is Stafford really? A friend of the people or a bossy technocrat? And how does Fernando's Marxist past shape his future in the capitalist Silicon Valley? And what about the bond between the two of them, Stafford and Fernando? Can it survive the traumas of the coup and Allende's downfall? And then there is the biggest mystery of them all. What happened to the operations room in Santiago? Stay tuned for the final episode of the Santiago Boys, where all will be revealed. The Santiago Boys is a co-production of Quora Media and Post-Utopia. Writing, research, development, and presentation, Evgeny Morozov. Music main theme, Luca Michele. Audio editing and post-production, Mattia Luciotti. Music supervisor, Luca Michele. Post-production assistant, Lucrezia Marcelli. Post-production producer, Matteo Salsa. The people who've been helping me to organize, record, and process hundreds of interviews are unfortunately too many to name here. But I'd like to extend special thanks to Chiara De Leone, Ekaitz Kansela, Nikolai Maximchuk, and Matteo Miavaldi, all of whom have helped me in more than one way. Full credits are also available on the podcast website, the-santiago-boys.com.
There's no conscience. Because of Ukraine, very low chances to join NATO. But the economy of Finland cannot be so easily integrated into the Russian political capitalism. And of course, in Ukraine, there are still some valuable for the Russian economy pieces of industry which could be very easily incorporated into formerly unified economy. As it actually happened in these puppet states in Donbass, in Donetsk and Lugansk, in the eastern Ukraine, which in just a matter of years were overtaken by the political capitalist close to the former Ukrainian regime of Viktor Yanukovych, but also to the Russian state. And so that could be a very much likely future for the occupied Ukrainian territories. They're overtaken, at least of those parts of the industry which would remain not destroyed, unlike in Mariupol, into the Russian economy. And that would be much easier than taking over the Western European economy. So that's my idea about this. And about the Ukrainian ruling class and their connections to Russia, genealogically, in their origins, they are the same kind of post-Soviet political capitalists who also exploited the connections to the old Soviet nomenclatura in order to become very rich in a matter of years. They instrumentalized Ukrainian nationalism in order to legitimate their claim for the part of the collapsing Soviet state, not really believing very much in the Ukrainian national idea, and they had actually a very big problem how to identify Ukraine in a positive way. And the title of a book of Ukrainian second president, Leonid Kuchma, is very illustrative, is very telling. In this respect, he called the book, Ukraine is not Russia. Okay, Ukraine is not Russia, but what is Ukraine then? And until this moment, they did have this problem with hegemony crisis. They could not articulate a positive development project that they would be able to lead and that would represent the interest of the whole nations. So these professional middle classes, they did have a kind of like quasi-modernization, ersatz-modernization project that we are joining EU, we are joining proper capitalism, we are joining the civilized world, and so we are going to live at least as good as Poland or Czech Republic. Of course, this would not happen. And they also did have the problem of hegemonizing their interests, and that's what I've just been talking about. But the connections of the Ukrainian ruling class to the Russian ruling class, they exist on the genealogical level, and they could compete in certain economic spheres even now. Although I would not see this war as, I mean, some dogmatic left may present it as like Russian oligarchs fighting against Ukrainian oligarchs. I believe there is a class conflict behind it, but it's very different class conflict. Ukrainian ruling class was actually divided about the prospects in relation to the transnational capital, which was coming with the anti-corruption agenda, and so a part of Ukrainian ruling class took the clearly a confrontationist position, and they were trying to claim the sovereignty, that all this anti-corruption is simply some kind of like George Soros conspiracy, and so on and so forth. They actually failed. Another part of Ukrainian oligarchs, they were trying to take an accommodationist strategy, so that yes, of course, we are joining the civilized world, but we need to understand that if you start to look into the offshore accounts of Poroshenko or Zelensky, just before the war, there was this Pandora Papers scandal with Zelensky's offshores, which nobody remembers now about and nobody cares now about, because this is the war, and if you start to criticize Zelensky, you are helping Putin. And so if you are capable to sell yourself as some indispensable figure in fight against Putin, the people would just close their eyes on your own corruption. So that's how it is, in very broad strokes.
The next question has been posted in our pad, so I read it out. When you talked about hegemony crisis, you pointed the limited opportunities for hegemony under demodernizing changes out. Can you explain what you exactly mean with demodernizing in this context? And is modernization then always a condition of hegemony?
Yeah, okay, great question. What is demodernization in the post-Soviet societies? When you have a high added value economy, which was capable to produce space rockets, computers, advanced machines, and which are basically sold for pennies in the 1990s, and are not needed anymore, and the economy is degraded into the extraction and sell of the very low added value goods. In Russian cases, the fundamentals of the economy, gas and oil. In Ukrainian case, it was kind of metallurgy, but also on the quite low level of development. And so instead of the technological advance in economy, you've got the degradation of the economy, demodernization in this case. In political level, You have the politicized society, you have like degrading but still ideological party, which articulates some clear ideologies. As a result, you get the politics dominated by personalistic patronage networks and interests. From more complicated politics, you get more primitive politics. On the level of culture, the number of people who read books, who read press, the number of intelligent press declines. The return of the multiple problems that were actually at least temporarily solved in the Soviet Union, on the level of healthcare, let's say, on the level of basic education, returning back. So these are all the things that I would call demodernization. Gramsci could say about this as history goes back instead of going forward. And that's why, I believe that all the discussion about the passive revolution is very misleading. And whether the hegemony is necessarily should be combined with the modernization, good question. I didn't think it through yet. But I would say that that modernization is indeed something very beneficial for the hegemony, because you have more opportunities to connect the interests of the different groups who could give an active, rational, participatory consent in the societal change. When the demodernization process happens, there are lesser opportunities to at least partially fulfill the interests of other groups. So whether it's a very strong necessity connection, not sure, but this is definitely, modernization is definitely very conducive to the possibilities for hegemony. And demodernization reduces these opportunities.
I have a question on the relationship of the ruling classes of Russia or the post-Soviet states towards China. And because you said that the American hegemony is shrinking, and that the Russian war, if Russia's victorious, that it might strengthen the position of the ruling classes of Russia. And that's also the question on how the ruling class is structured in Russia, because I think that the conflict is not just a regional Eastern European conflict, but also a representation of some historic global transformation process, where the world economic power is concentrating more in China, and China is becoming the new center of world market regulations, not just because other countries are tired, but also because that we are since the 70s in a structural over accumulation of capital because of modernization and the problem of effective demand for on the one hand and higher productivity and rising output of productive capital, and so I think that this is also this transformation process is also a representation of the economic laws that that capitalism is going to an end. And I also think that this makes it more that there is a rising necessity of the state to do state intervention and deficit spending or other things. So a transformation, so that there is a transformation process toward some kind of socialist market economy, maybe, I don't know. But so that's why I'm asking that if Russia is winning the war in the Ukraine, that it may boost this transformation process, and if it is even useful for the or how it is useful or in the long run positive for the ruling class in Russia, if this kind of state intervention and deficit spending may put a negative light or on the legitimation of the ruling classes in Russia, so that the ruling classes, if they are capitalist traditionally, like here in the Western, then state intervention and deficit spending or other kind of policies may shrinken the power or decrease the power of this class and destroy their legitimation, which is why they are against those measures. And so my question is, how are the relationships toward China from the political class and from the leading class in Russia, and what's their position on this global transformation process, if you have ideas on that?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I'm not a Russia-China specialist, not a specialist on the Russia-China relations, but what I would comment in the context of Gramsci is that the Russian, international-oriented ideology right now is very non-hegemonic. So they need to present their war as the war for, not just for Russia, but for other nations who are dissatisfied with the US order, or US-led order, or US hegemony. But at the same time, they do not have any positively articulated project for the world. And what they articulate now is the kind of like civilizational ideology. So we are kind of like an ancient Russian civilization, so we have some legitimate claims on the part of the world where Ukraine is allegedly belongs to. And China is also a very ancient civilization, and they also have a sovereign claim on the part of the world, and it should be recognized as equal with other great powers. And there are also Brazil, South Africa, India. And that, of course, raises the question, who is the great power and who is supposed to be kind of like subservient to the great power who would claim a sovereign claim over their lands. But the point is that the whole project is simply demarcation of the territory with references to some kind of like civilizational legitimacy, which is, of course, the claim made to the local elites in the greater states that could join Russia in this project. But this is not exactly a hegemonic project. This is not exactly some project that would articulate the progressive change for the world. So in Russian rhetoric, they identify...